Okay, today is a fascinating shiur. First of all, I want to mention that Thursday was a very sad day for me. We buried Rebbetzin Hinder Katz. And I just want to say a few words. When I entered yeshiva in 51, my first Rebbe was Reb Michal Katz. I had him for 2 years, actually, because the Rebbe we had the second year died very young, unmarried, Holocaust survivor, Shanghai crowd, Mira. Who knows what World War II did to him, the tension. And after a few weeks, we were back with Reb Michal Katz, and they moved up to the second level. And Reb Michal was a wonderful Rebbe. He combined within himself three different worlds. He himself, born in Europe, where his father was a Rav, Reb Reuven Katz. Then the father becomes Chief Rabbi of Petach Tikva. He then lives in Israel. Then comes to America, and he actually combined very successfully Europäische Yeshivat, the Israel scene, and the American scene as well. But more than the classroom, what I'm forever indebted to Reb Michal and his wife was Friday night, they opened their home to the students. And you have to remember, YU at that time, its greatest contingent of students were from the Bronx. YU was right across the bridge, a minute away, 2 minutes away. If you walk across, it was called the Washington Bridge, not the George Washington, but the Washington Bridge. If you walked away across the bridge, you would be in Washington Heights from the heart of the Bronx in a space 5-10 minutes at the most. I may be overstating it when I say 10 minutes. And we all lived in the Bronx, the greater Mount Eden area. The Katzes lived on 1475 Grand Concourse. And it was like a dessert reception. Everyone walked over after Sudat Shabbat, and we spoke at Divrei Torah. Rav Michal told stories, and Hinder had a spread. And they were just wonderful people. And you have to understand, it's hard for today's generation where there's so many Shomrei Shabbos, Baruch Hashem. I don't say everyone is a tzaddik. Unfortunately, the more Shomrei Shabbos we have, percentage-wise, the more number-wise, I should say, the more phonies we have among them. But that's part of life. Ameich kulam tzaddik, and we haven't yet achieved. And it was just a spiritual oasis in the desolate Bronx. You couldn't find the Shomrei Shabbos family if you looked with a magnifying glass. Everyone worked on Shabbos, and I told you, in my building, whenever I had a difficult question in Gemara, I went to the other side of my building. There were endless families, 2115 Washington Avenue, and I would ask this gentleman to help me in Gemara. He would come home from work Shabbos, and right after he ate lunch, he would learn Gemara. And Nebuch, that was the situation. No one, and these were very good Jewish homes, but everyone worked on Shabbos. My grandfather, that Zayda, who had no learning, he knew how to daven, and he had, you know, been raised in Europe, and the only language he spoke was Yiddish, even though he lived in America, I would say well over 70 years. He was never mechallel Shabbos, that Zayda. My other Zayda, who learned in the Lashon and could quote Gemaras by heart, all that remained was a kosher home, and my mother telling me stories about how frum her mother's family was in Kovna, and of course I only listened with one ear, and only many, many decades later did I find out that I'm related to Rabbi Rebbe. We're all from the Kalbariski family, and everything my mother would tell me about her mother's family, and I didn't listen. My mother was born in Harlem. What does she know about Kovna? She never set foot in Kovna, Kalmas. And I came closer to Kovna than my mother. I taught in Vilna under the communist era, during the communist era, as you know. So it was really a beautiful moment. And I remained very close to the family. I had the schut later in life to teach two granddaughters. And it was a family that had tremendous tragedy. I just spoke with my brother, and he remembers it like yesterday as well. And he's younger than I am, in 66. You know, there was always this hang-up that YU was not frum enough. All right, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true, I don't know. I can't comment. But so people would send their kids away. Tells was a big attraction. Baltimore, a big attraction. Get the kid out of the city. Let him go to a good high school, get a good foundation. Rav Michal and his, he had a brother, Leon Katz, was Rabbi of Passaic. I knew both brothers quite well. Rabbi Dr. Leon Katz, Rabbi Dr. Michal Katz. And the Leon and Michael both had the sons that were 14 years old, 13, 14. And they sent them away to Baltimore. And lo aleinu, there was a fire in the house on a Shabbos, on a Friday night. And these kids had rented a room upstairs and Rabbi Milakovsky's home, I believe. And the kids were burned to death, both boys. I was at the funeral, and it took tremendous to overcome that. When you lose a child, it's very difficult. And Hindi gave Reb Michal a lot of strength. Everyone feared that he couldn't survive. Reb Cheshin just died, the judge. And if you read the obituaries, everyone says he could. His son was killed a few years ago in a car accident. Someone ran him over. And he never was the same after his son was killed. You have to have tremendous strength and tremendous spiritual strength to survive the loss of a child. We all know it in Israel. I don't know. I don't want to go further. And Hindi gave him a lot of strength. And they're buried right next to each other. There's the son, Shmuel. My brother was Shmuel's madrich in Eagle Day Camp. And I don't believe Eretz Chaim in Beit Shemesh was on the map with a cemetery in 66. So evidently they brought him over here. And next to him is Reb Michal, and Hindi was buried right on the other side. And as I mentioned yesterday, I just told my brother, it never happened to me before. Lo aleinu, you know, even at a moment of despair, there's a good laugh. It was a very small crowd. I said just, I was very upset. I came into Grish. I thought Grish should send an honor guard. Reb Michal was a Rebbe in YU for more than 60 years. Send an honor guard to the funeral. I walked in here, you know, I don't want to mention names, but even the finest Rabbanim here looked at me, who, what, when, where, you know. That's life. Dor Chadash, Vayakum Dor Chadash, Shelo Yadat Yosef. So I was the only one who went to the funeral. My grandson, thank God, drove Malcolm, myself, and we picked up Rabbi Gorelick and his wife, who also knew Reb Michal and Hinda very well. And their nephew was Maspid. And the nephew gets up, he's a Rabbi Strutzkin. Reb Michal's sister married a Rabbi Strutzkin from the Telz family. And he gets up, and the whole chesped is from Washington to Washington. He's reading word by word what the author wrote about Reb Michal and Hinda Katz. And then when he's finished, he asks, by any chance, is Harav Raketet in the audience? And everyone pointed, and I was sitting right in front of him. So I write, at least my book did some good. Now, we're talking about the Rebbe, and I want to come back to last week's shiur, and I want to spend the whole shiur today going a little deeper and a little deeper. A lot has happened since we last met, and what can I tell you? If I had the ego, I would declare myself the Maplewood Rebbe. I would already have a beard and pay us and ask you to chip in so I could buy a nice drywall. And I'd be all set. Why? I'll tell you why. B'didi Havayuv, that actually happened. Last week we spoke about the Rebbe in Berlin and then going to France. And there's no question that he devoted part of his time to secular studies. This was the attraction, this was the great pull of the Western world and the minds that went there. We mentioned names last week. I mean, Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Avraham Yehoshua Heschel, Rav Yitzchak Kutner, the future Lubavitcher Rebbe, Nechama Leibovitch, Rav Chaim Heller was there, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg was there, Rav Avraham Eliyahu Kaplan was there. I mean, it's beyond words what Berlin attracted. The Shemin V'Solet of Eastern European Jewry. And in Berlin, in my humble opinion, from all I've read, I didn't do a doctorate on it, but I think I know, in Berlin, the Rebbe enjoyed himself taking courses of what was of interest to him. He audited classes. He was able to do that because he had smicha from Yehiel Yaakov Weinberg, everything we spoke about last week, and the Berlin University opened its doors to him. In France, he got serious, and he went to school. And he gets a degree in electrical engineering, specializing in electrical engineering in relation to boats, ships. So if you recall, I said last week, it's very fascinating that the Rebbe worked on boats, and he worked for the Brooklyn Navy Yard in the early part of the 1940s, La Priyut. And we don't know exactly what the Rebbe did. And I said that in class. Somehow that has never been revealed. Do you know that I said that Monday morning and Monday afternoon on JEM, I believe it is. They sent me a link. I saw it. I couldn't believe it. In the leading Chabad Jewish educational media website, they had an interview with an expert on electrical engineering and ships who met with the Rebbe and interviewed him in 1957 and spoke with him for hours about what the Rebbe did in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And it turns out that the Rebbe told them five ships were built for which he had the responsibility to check that all the electrical engineering was up to par, and the ships could only go further once the Rebbe gave the okay. And this person interviewing him, who evidently is very well known in his field, I don't know if he's alive, this interview may be recorded a while ago, was overwhelmed by the Rebbe's knowledge. And what was most interesting is how they had just developed a new format of dealing with electrical engineering, and they were leaving a vacuum tubes, whatever it was called, the Morty, you can correct me, and they were going into something much smaller. And the Rebbe was so interested in that, and he kept on asking him 1,000 different questions about what the implications are and what this will mean in the future. And of course, he was overwhelmed by the Rebbe's knowledge. So I got a number of emails declaring me Ruach HaKodesh Rebbe, that in the morning I should raise the question, and in the afternoon it's answered. I thank all the, I want to say hello to all those listening. I thank you so much for those nice emails. I have to tell you, I don't have an ego. I can't be a Rebbe. But worse than that, I can't listen to Tzaris. You heard me yesterday. Those shilas I got over the summer ripped my heart apart. You understand? You raise a kid to be frum, and the kid says, what good is religion if the rabbi that I looked up to was the biggest phony in the world? No, how can you deal with that? I can't be a Rebbe, so let the others take the role of a Rebbe and let me just be a Malamed. Now, I mentioned, I got a note from a professor, from Dr. Bill Gewirtz, who says, I'm not sure your characterization of the Rebbe's engineering school comparing it to MIT or the Technion is accurate. Harlman Friedman described it as a more technical than engineering, with details and many supporting documents, not really first-rate in their view. So I have to plead guilty that I really am not an expert in this area. And Morty, if you want, research it and come back. Charlie, you have a PhD in science from Harvard. Am I right or wrong? Yeah, but you have in, what is it, physics? What do you have it in? Molecular biology. Come on, I'm sitting here with geniuses. Me anochi. Research it. But I have to tell you, Harman and Friedman have a prejudice against the Rebbe in France. If you read their description, it's a little bit prejudiced. All I can say is the Rebbe passed the courses and got the degree. His brother-in-law did not pass. And his brother went back to Poland, and that part of the family was killed by Hitler. Halavai, he would have passed, it might have been a different story. Also, something else that I said, I got from a Talmud, Meyer Grutkopf at Chabad. So I mentioned about a kvittel and a pigeon nefesh. So he's correct. The Hasidic, that this goes for all Hasidic Rebbeim. But Lubavitch, zelichud v'zelichud. When you sent the Rebbe a kvittel, there was no money with it. Generally, once a year on Purim, they made an appeal for the Rebbe's house and for the Tompei Tamimim. I remember Yutat Kislev, they would make an appeal, if I'm correct, for Tompei Tamimim at the end of the Fabrengen in the wee hours of the morning, and thousands of checks would be passed up front. So I stand not corrected, but the more information that with Chabad, a kvittel zelichud v'zelichud. With the Gera Rebbe, it works the opposite way. And that's what I've told you many times. The Gera dynasty is extremely wealthy. The reason they're extremely wealthy in my family, you know, if is the biggest word in the dictionary. Malka's father, we had a tragedy in her family in 35. Her aunt fell through the lake in Lake Placid. There was ice. You went skating on the ice. And these girls, her aunt, that family, outside of her father, were very Americanized. And you had to enjoy life in America. And Lola Lenu went skating on the ice, fell through the ice and drowned. So that year or a year afterwards, Malka's grandfather and father, who was not yet married, visited Palestine to get away from their tsaras. And Malka's grandfather could have bought up a plot of land in Tel Aviv for $100. Do you have any idea what that land later became worth? No, so you made $100 was a lot of money, 1935. There's someone saying to me, Rakefet here, make an investment, come up with $10,000, and we guarantee you in 20 years your descendants will be multi-millionaires, linked millionaires, indexed millionaires. So Martha's father never bought it. And we always say, if Saba had bought that land, now the Gera Rebbeim visited the third Gera Rebbe, the Re'em, Rav Avraham Mordechai Alter, the son of the Sfat Emet, visited Israel, Palestine, I should say, about 7 or 8 times between World War I to World War II. Each time he visited, he bought land. And I don't have to go further. In the Gera dynasty, there's always one individual assigned to look after all their holdings. So they never raised money for the family per se. The Rebbe daf nish kavim kein geld. Lehefech. The Rebbe sit. I saw this with my own eyes. During the winter, he sits with oranges. During the summer, with apples. Tremendous crates. And every chassid, when he's finished with the kvittel and unburdening himself to the Rebbe, the Rebbe gives him advice. The Rebbe gives him a bracha. The Rebbe gives him a gift: an apple, an orange. You walk away with something. The only time they raise money is for their school system. And there they have their own system. They go away for a weekend. I had a friend, I think I told you, to go away and be with the Rebbe for the weekend, I think was a minimum of $25,000 cash. And people come from all over the world. Some 25 is nothing, some $1 million. You understand that Rebbe's the Rebbe? I should be on that level to be with the Rebbe for a weekend. You gladly and happily put $1 million on the table. Now, I want to raise a very serious question now, a question that I don't believe we can give a black and white answer for, but a question that flows over into my world as well. Here you see the Rebbe studying general studies, friendly with Rav Soloveitchik, part and parcel of the Berlin scene, afterwards the French scene, rubbing shoulders, rubbing shoulders with all types of scientists and learned people. And you know, even if you've read Deutsch's volumes, it seems the Rebbe in Berlin lived down the block from Einstein. And Einstein held a concert, or went to a concert, and Einstein played the violin. I don't know if you're aware of that. And he was a fairly good violin player, and it was to raise money for some cause. And right around the corner from the Rebbe, Einstein entertained, and they raised money. And until today, there's a whole machlokes of chokrim, of researchers, whether the young Rabbi Schneerson attended the concert of Einstein, whether they met, whether they spoke. But you see, the Rebbe rubs shoulders, and he's part of this big world. And yet, when he becomes Rebbe, never, ever did he encourage a regular Chabadnik go to college, go to graduate school. I have students who became Chabadnikim. I met one student, I actually met him in Los Angeles a few years ago. And he hugged me, kissed me, my student 40 years ago, maybe more. And he said, "You were the only Rebbe I had who encouraged me." He was from Detroit and became a Chabadnik. And he was in BMT. I don't believe in this building. I think it was when we were in Rehov Neely. And every other Rebbe laughed at him and poked fun at him and said, "You were the only Rebbe I had who encouraged me." Right? I had him. I remember I had a young lady in Michlala, became a Chabadnik. So I, they asked the Rebbe, I couldn't believe my with this young lady, she asked the Rebbe, what should she do after her year in Michala? And this girl was gung-ho, Eretz Yisrael, Shleima, and I was telling her, you have to go to Bar Ilan University and settle here, and what's the question you love? So she wrote to the Rebbe, and I saw the answer with my own eyes, Beit Yaakov Kadima. I couldn't believe my eyes. I saw then, I heard other stories, students, the Rebbe, Yeshiva Kedosha, not one word of general studies, of secular studies. And here you come to the question, and the question, I'm the first one to raise it, where does the Rebbe stand? What are we talking about? And this is a fascinating question. My own opinion is, and I can't say when it comes to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I can't say I'm the world expert, but I can only share my own opinion with you. It goes back to what I mentioned in passing a week or two ago, last lecture or two lectures ago. If you recall, Rabbi Avram Yehoshua Heschel, the Azun from Rishon Rabbeim, the biggest Rishon Yichus in the world. He's related to every Rishon Rebbe you can mention. And they were furious. He's going to Berlin. And finally, his uncle, who is a Rebbe, said to him, all right, you can go, but only you can go, nobody else. And I think what the Rebbe's attitude was that really, if we had a choice, a pristine choice, with no outside influence, the average person should only learn Torah and Hasidus and not be engaged with the big world beyond. Engagement with the big world beyond is for the chosen few who can handle it. And if you take this attitude that this is not for the Hamon Ha'am, this is not for the masses, then you can understand the Rebbe. He was friendly with every scientist. He never told anyone who was studying for a PhD, stop studying for a PhD. He never told anyone who was publishing books, writing books, creating scholarship. He never told them to desist. The opposite. But he never told anyone to begin. If you're coming to me and asking for my advice, Torat Hashem Tamima. If one was a wise aleck and would say to the Rebbe, which I guess no one had the guts, so Rebbe, how come you went to college in Erzurum? So the answer would be, I'm a Rebbe, I'm a little bit different. Are you on my level? Can you handle it all? This is the way I would understand the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It's not so much that there's a contradiction here. It's not that he's living on two different levels. It's that there's the choice for everybody and the lifestyle for the chosen few. And that answer to Rav Avram Yehoshua Heschel, after yelling and shouting at him, finally they agree, you can go, but no one else. It may be that this explains the Rebbe and his approach. He was very open, and no one can ever say he was narrow. And you know who came to Farabrengen, and you know how many college professors, world famous people, became Lubavitch Chassidim, and you know that the man's knowledge and what he spoke about and art. I remember seeing Jacques Lifshitz, the famous artist, sculptor, sitting in front of the Rebbe, B'dechilu Rechimu. And this is the way I understand it. Now, there is a fallout here, because I want to now ask a question in a world where I know a little bit more. Tell me, Mori Urebi, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, what was his approach? If you would say to Rebbe, we're going to build an ideal world. We're building it. What kind of world do we build? Do we build the world of Yeshiva University? Or do we build a world where we just learn Torah and no other study matters? It's a very fascinating question. And I want to tell you, there's the simple answer that you might want to think is correct is not correct at all. Because the Rav was very, very different than Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch. Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch. And you know, today there's some Yekis sitting here, and I'm an honorary Yekis with six Yekis grandchildren. There's some yogis who will tell you, no, Rav Hirsch, don't believe everything he wrote. He wrote it because he was dealing with a generation that was running away and was becoming reformed, becoming assimilated, and he had to influence them, and therefore he wrote this beautiful concept of Torim Derech Eretz. And you know, I'm quoting Hirsch now, the 19 letters. Who put the Jew into the ghetto? We didn't choose to be in the ghetto. The Gentiles put us into the ghetto. We have to live in the big world. We have to sanctify the big world. We have to conquer the big world. We have to be part of the big world. That's Rav Hirsch. Did he really mean it? I'll leave it to the great experts of German Orthodoxy to reach a decision. It's a tremendous machloket. I would like to believe that if Rav Hirsch wrote this, he believed it with his heart and soul. And all his educational institutions were open, were different. The high school, the Beit Sefer Reali. I mean, you're dealing here with his knowledge of German culture, of German literature. Wow. Read Schwab's history, came out in 48. It should be reprinted. It's a classic work written by someone who had no prejudice, by the uncle of Rabbi Shimon Schwab, written by Hermann Schwab, came out in London in 1948, The History of Orthodox Judaism in Germany. I believe that's the title. Fabulous volume.
It was an English book? English.
Fabulous volume. All right. The Rav, was he a Hirschian? And here, you know, you come to a very delicate question. There's no question, Ish halacha, kifshua ta'aretz, miluhu, conquer, research, a doctor, discoveries, vaccines, you get an absolute Hirschian approach. And yet, there's another side to the Rav. And if people ask me, what do I consider the most valuable scholarship that I ever published? It's in volume 2 of the Rav. I uncovered 2 talks Rebbe gave in the it's a long time ago, the 50s. Talks were given in Yiddish. And I transcribed them and translated them into English. I gave them in the Kollel many, many years ago. The talks have never been published. I don't know why they were never, because I gave the Liechtensteins my Xerox copy of everything I did. But it could be they felt the talks were limited into time. It's not eternal. I don't know. The heart of those talks, I summarize, I quote word by word in the second volume, the chapters on Yeshiva University in volume 2. And there it's very fascinating where the Rav explains how he's totally different than Rav Hirsch. As much as he admired the Frumkeit in Germany, and that's where the Rav tells the famous story, and he repeated the story many times, how he was friendly with Professor Mittwoch, who was the dean of the Berlin University Graduate School of Semitics. I taught his granddaughter in Michala, Hadassah Mittwoch, who later marries, he died recently, the rabbi in Ofra, I believe it was, a very interesting individual. He would meet with the Islamic spiritual leaders. If I forget his last name, anyone can help me? She was Hadassah Mittwoch. And he, I see his face in front of me. But all right, I have to ask my daughter's his name. It's a name you all know. A very interesting individual. He was idiosyncratic. He was not run of the mill. And so I gave Hadassah Mittwoch a copy of the recording where the Rav talks about her great uncle, I believe it was. And the Rav said, you talk about Frumkeit in Germany, Professor Mittwoch came to the university on Tisha B'Av with Tisha B'Av shoes. And the Rav said, remember, University of Berlin was not Columbia University of today. Today in Columbia University, yes, you can go with Tisha B'Av shoes, with a 9-day beard. No one's going to laugh at you. This was University of Berlin and total dedication to the halacha. But the Rav said, with all my admiration for the dedication to the halacha, our main goal in life is to have a yeshiva. And yeshiva has to be like Voloshin and like Britsk and like yeshiva throughout the generations. And then the Rav adds a postscript, and I'm quoting him. And Rabbi Foreman, the name Hadassah was Rebbetzin Foreman. That's the name of her husband, Foreman. I believe it was Menachem Foreman, but I may be wrong on the first name. Check it out. Go to the computer. Foreman. She was Hadassah Mittwoch. And the Rav said, but a yeshiva, pure. And because the times demand it, we also have to have a college. Very interesting. Because the times demand it. Very interesting. Froman, yeah.
Froman.
That's him. What's his first name?
Menachem.
Okay, Baruch Hashem. And his wife was Hadassah, Menachem Froman. And Rabbi, he was idiosyncratic. He was a character, interesting guy. I knew him to a certain degree. I saw him right before he died, and we had conversations over the years, and Hadassah was a very bright, brilliant lady, a wonderful student, early 70s, Michalah, and left a beautiful, beautiful family. But the Rav said, because the times demand it. Now that's interesting. What would Rebbe say if you had freedom of choice? The times don't demand it. Would we still need university, graduate school, Harvard, Yale, MIT, Wesley, Radcliffe, New England? The Rav was a Brahmin. He loved New England culture. I don't know. I once raised this issue. I gave a talk in California, and a week later, the rabbi gave a talk against me as if I had desecrated the Aron Kodesh, but implying the rabbi. But there's a lasagnas and rabbanim. I'm very happy if someone thinks I'm off the wall and criticizes me. So lasagnas and enjoy yourself. I'll tell you something else. My own personal feeling. I can tell you a family. I don't want to mention the name. He was a graduate of what you call today Skokie. This is the father, going back 70, 80 years. He raised his kids right wing, didn't send them to YU. And the Rav, one of the kids, later becomes active, organizes a Beit Din, and he comes to the Rav and speaks with him in learning. And the Rav walked away so impressed. And I was thinking to myself, I heard the Rav say, mit dem kennen retten, er versteht, he understands. And I was, I wanted to say, Rebbe, he never went to college. He barely graduated high school. What are you so proud of? But you see, the learning, the ability to learn, to paskin, to understand, I can understand, Rebbe. A lot of the frumkai going on, I can't swallow because they don't know what they're talking about. That's why I proposed Reb David Feinstein yesterday, because Reb David Feinstein versteht wie zu paskinen. This is Reb Moshe's son. Of all his children, he's the one who mastered the father 100%. Reb Reuven went out into the world. Reb Reuven did great things, but Reb David is Reb David. There's a difference. Everyone is different. An edler and a fashtay. You take the example I threw out right now with the mitzitza bepeh. Anyone who understands halacha, the flow of halacha, the devach Hashem, they just found that mitzitza bepeh may be a cause of Alzheimer's later in life. The herpes disease. There's research. Go to the websites now. You'll see what's coming out.
So if the Chatam Sofer already said no mitzitza b'peh, if Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav, said no mitzitza b'peh, if Rav Yoshev, I have it in writing, I'll show it to you in the Sunday class when I come to it in a few weeks' time or in a few years' time, Be'ezrat Hashem, no mitzitza b'peh. How could you? What are they doing? They're killing kids. It's Ritzicha. We're dealing here with Baal Hashem, with Halacha. So that's what I mentioned. Rav David came out. They can't come out against Rav David, but you notice they push them aside. They ignore him. Now, this is a very interesting question. Halacha l'maisa, in the year 2016 where we are today, don't misquote me. There is no doubt in my mind that the Rav would hold that in America and in Israel and anywhere there are Jews today, we not only have to be great in learning, but we have to produce great scholars in every field imaginable and great medical doctors and conquer the Technion and all kinds of engineering and invent new weapons, umiluat arfikivshuhu, and farming and innovation and all that's being done and the world and the computerization. It's an unbelievable world. There's no doubt in my mind. But imagine if we have to go to college. But imagine if we would have the choice, if we could just sit and learn and surround ourselves with Shas, Poskim, Kedusha, what would the Rav say? See, I believe he would have a different answer than Rav Hirsch. According to Rav Hirsch, if he really meant what he wrote, no doubt about it. You need college, university, you have to do your share. Rebbe, perhaps the Gentiles have their own life. Their own life is to build great hospitals, produce great medical research. Our role in life is to know Shasim, Paiskim, and Kol HaTorah Kula by heart, and to be Ovdei Hashem. I don't know. You can think about it. It's a fascinating, fascinating question. Okay. That's the way I view the Rebbe, and I believe I'm correct, but anyone who wants to correct me is welcome to. The question that I raised last week, and that's what I want to concentrate on now, is a very, very important question. How can Hasidus get off the floor? Just because the father's a tzaddik, so what? You look into Nach, you look into Tanakh, Moshe Rabbeinu, what became of his own children, his own grandchildren? I don't even want to say it, I don't even want to mouth it, but you know what the Midrashim say. And by the way, there's a lot to be said about that, because a Rav who's a public figure always pays a price. That's part of the nature of the game. It may be that the Lubavitcher Rebbe was cursed with a blessing that he didn't have any children. That it's a curse, of course. But the Ribbono Shel Olam knew who he would become, and he could only become that by not having any other loyalty or devotion. And I remember Mori Rebbe gave a drasha in the 50s where he cried. It was unbelievable. There was a Yahrzeit drasha, the Agada part, where he spoke about Moshe Rabbeinu, that to be Rabban Shel Yisrael, you had to give up your wife and give up your children. You couldn't devote an extra minute to your own family than you devoted to every child in Kol Yisrael. That was the price that Moshe Rabbeinu had to pay. And you think about it, think about it. And Rabbanim in public light, you all know the stories. You read the memoirs of children. My father had time for every child, not for me. Rabbi Revel, his two children, two sons, never married. And Mrs. Revel told me that one time Norman told off his father, "You had time for everyone else's son except your own son." And this is a price that you pay in the public life. This is why you have that expression in Yiddish, a Rav's Tochter. You ever heard that expression? A rabbi's daughter. Let me tell you, that expression means keep away from her if you have any belief in Torah Hashem. A Rav's Tochter. And listen, this is Freud. This is ingrained in the parent-child relationship. And that's why I always bless Rabbanim who raise children who remain from. It's a great achievement because you're in the public limelight. And so how can you have succession? The father was a tzaddik, the kids are. The question is a powerful question. And the answer is very simple. No one forces you to be a chassid of a certain Rebbe. There is freedom of choice. In the United States of America, a lot of Satmar Hasidim wound up in the Lubavitcher camp. Freedom of choice. A lot of Litvisha wound up Kloisenberger Hasidim when they saw the Kloisenberger Rebbe and his actions in the death camps. Read the memoir literature. And I knew people like that. Rav Asher Weiss, his father, you have many examples. Probably the most sterling example is Lubavitch, where the Hasidim went and anointed their Rebbe against the family wishes. It's probably the most sterling, poignant example in all the history of Hasidus. And I want to say, and I alluded to it last week, and we're going to come back to it a number of weeks from now, it's a big machloket. The family fought in public. This is not a private family. What goes on in your homes, no one knows about. The newspapers aren't reporting. The radio is not running talk shows. The TV is not recording and videoing. But the Lubavitcher family, by 1950, was a flashpoint for all of greater Jewry in the United States, certainly New York, but well beyond New York. Already Palestine, Israel. Lubavitch was Lubavitch. And this battle was fought in public. And it takes away your neshama when you think about it, but this is a reality of life. And here I'll tell you something that a fascinating little vart that you can think about for the next 50 years. Mori Rebbe, you know, in the classroom, he was hail, fire, and brimstone in my time. Did he have to be that way? Didn't he have to be that way? You can play with this forever. It could be that we turned out who we are only because the Rebbe was hail, fire, and brimstone. He didn't tolerate second-rate performance. Unfortunately, he mellowed in later years. As you know, he went through tremendous tragedy. 67, three avelot, one after another. Mother, brother, and then Churban Beit HaMikdash, his wife. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Chaf Bet. But you talk about family and fighting and publicity. Where could you bother the Rav and ask him questions you could never ask him in the classroom? And here's where the Rabbanim who went into the field and were rabbis and were members of RCA, when you had an RCA convention, particularly if the convention was 3 days and the hotel, let's say the Pine View, the Pioneer, wherever the convention was, they ran a special stay for over Shabbos with a special rate. So a lot of people stayed, and particularly when the Rebbetzin was gone and the Rav was still functioning, they cajoled Rebbe to stay through Monday morning. And that Shabbos, that Sunday, everyone walked around with baseball caps and formal clothes, all the famous Rabbanim, and they could ask Rebbe questions they would have never dared to ask 3-4 years earlier in the classroom. So one time, many Hoser told me this, they're sitting around the table and they're talking with Rebbe and they're talking about the various theories of what inspires a person to accomplish in life. And the Rav says, I'll tell you, there are three basic theories. Machiavelli, Marx, and Freud. And he says, all of them are wrong, and all of them are partially right. So they all look at Rebbe, and Rebbe says, I'll explain. Machiavelli, power, you want to get ahead. The prince, politician, the ends justify the means. Marx, money, das Kapitalist. Freud, sex, parent-child relationship, the Freudian relationship, as we call it. Sex, which endlessly comes up in Freud's writings and analysis, etc. He says each one thinks they're totally right. That's where they're wrong. They're each one-third right. And then Rebbe started to bring Maimari Chazal that support Machiavelli, that support Marx, Mishay Shlomana, Rotzeh Matayim, Machiavelli, Al Titvadal Rishut, they only need you for their own purposes. And of course, when it comes to sex, Sein Apitropos Halarayot, etc., etc., Chesed Yibana Olam, it's endless. And the fellas walked away. That one third of Freud is where we get the worst publicity. When families fight, when rebbeim fight, when children fight, and when it's in public. But it's part of the human being. It's part of human nature. It's something we have to live with. And in every family, you'll uncover this one doesn't talk with that one. This one is mad at this one. This one was slighted. You'll hear stories. What's fascinating is it can skip a generation. The children are mad, and the grandchildren go back, are the best friends. It's ongoing. It's fascinating. It's the human being. It's what gives psychologists such a large following today. And even in the state of Israel, when we came in Aliyah, you never heard the word a psychologist, a psycholog, a psychiatra. You never heard those words. But as Israel grows into a more advanced capitalistic country and money is available, this is part and parcel of life today. Every school psychologist. And this is a reality. We have to live with it. We have to accept it. Now, this battle was a tremendous battle. And as I said last week, and I'm going to go a little deeper now, as I said last week, there's no question that the family wanted the elder son-in-law, Reb Shmaya Guraye, to become Rebbe. There's no question in my mind, and I believe anyone who researches the Rebbe's life will reach the same conclusion, that the Rebbe had no desire, no dream to become Rebbe. Lehefech, all our literature about the Rebbe, all our memoir literature about the Rebbe describes him as reticent, shy, not seeking any publicity. The Rav, and you can read this in David Holzer, the book, The Rav Thinking Aloud. So David records conversations he had with the Rav. He records the conversation about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And the Rav may say, Lefitumo. In a million years, I don't believe he knew David was recording him. I don't believe he would ever dream that he's going to be quoted in Yerushalayim. But may say, Lefitumo. The Rav says, the Rebbe, he was shy. He was reticent. No one could believe that this man would become the Lubavitcher Rebbe that he became. It's not only the Rav who says it, but the Rav's testimony is fabulous because that's someone who knew him as a chaver, as an intimate friend, as a buddy. Can I use slang? As a buddy. They didn't, when they looked at each other, the Rav was Beryl and then this was Mendel. You understand? This wasn't B'yirat HaKovid, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rav Soloveitchik. It was Beryl and Mendy. And the Rav, talking decades later, thinking back to the 1920s, no one could have believed that this man would become what he became. Yes, occasionally he spoke in public when his father-in-law commanded him to. But Dafka was in France. He was not near the Rebbe. He visited the Rebbe. He helped the Rebbe. He helped edit the Rebbe's writings, other writings, whatever the Rebbe wanted. He was a servant and a servant of his father-in-law. But the one who was the right hand of the Rebbe was Reb Shmayel Goraye, who traveled with the Rebbe. Now, it is true that he did speak in public occasionally, because the Rebbe asked him to. When he came to America, once a month, the Rebbe already couldn't speak in public, he had a stroke, so he would ask his sons-in-law to hold a fabrengen. And let me translate what a fabrengen means. A fabrengen in Hasidic terminology, particularly Chabad, it's not just that the Rebbe is speaking. Fabrengen means when a group of Hasidim come together. I have Chabad friends. So one of them would always say, "Menda fabrengen abisof." You know what that means? You get together with 10, 15 of your friends, you pull out a bottle of vodka, a little lekach, and you start a Hasidic niggin, and you tell a story about the Rebbe, and someone says, "Oh, the Divrei Torah, and drink the lechayim, das heis fabrengen." So the sixth Rebbe told his son-in-law, once a month, the Ramash, as he was known. One was the Rashak, Rav Shmai Guraye, and Rav Menachem Schneerson, Ramash. Once a month, he spoke in public. Now, you have to understand, and in America I'm talking about. So obviously, people started to know him, to see him, to feel who this man is. When did he make the decision to become Rebbe? And we spoke about last night that famous Fabrengen on Yud Shvat 1951. And we'll come back to it in a minute. I'll give you an eyewitness account. My understanding is it was a gradual process. It didn't happen overnight. But Hasidim already knew who he was. He held Fabrengens in Paris. He held regular monthly Fabrengens in New York. Hasidim who were stranded in America during World War II. Hasidim who after World War II were able to come in and visit the Rebbe from London where there was a large Chabad presence. They knew who this man was. And they started to pressure him. And slowly but surely, I believe, he ultimately made the decision that God has anointed him to be the seventh Rebbe. It didn't happen overnight. I'm positive he made the decision with his wife's approval. I'm positive he made the decision because he saw there was no way out. The continuity of Chabad depended upon his saying yes. Could be what I said before is correct, the fact that he had no children. And it's wonderful to have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, but I can tell you, it's very time-demanding. I am an active grandfather and an active great-grandfather. It is time demanding. Just yesterday, a grandson gave us hell that we haven't visited him yet in his office in Tel Aviv. All right, we agreed, Chalamai, we're going to Tel Aviv. And Tel Aviv is not so simple for me to go to Tel Aviv anymore. Published the kayach, but a grandson is a grandson. Maybe he realized that he's not going to have children and God wants him in this position. It was a gradual process. And when he made that final decision, as Rabbi Steinsaltz says so insightfully, he no longer was Mendel, Mendeler,
Menachem Mendel, he became Lubavitcher Rebbe, and his entire private persona was lost forever. The only moments he was Mendel again was when he had tea with his wife daily. And you have to stand in awe of this man. And as I've said so many times, and I don't know, it hurts me because I see these rebbeim, they write up, you know, I read the part of the Haredi press. I admit, I have a deep love for the Haredi world, with all their faults. I'm not a Haredi, take my word for it. I can show you a million faults. I just was shivering, shaking. I think I gave it to you yesterday in Lakewood. They put up pictures not to buy Taster's Choice coffee. It has a woman picking the coffee beans off the tree. What that, if that, God, if they're incited by the sight of that woman, these are lowlifes. They should be executed in public. Get rid of men like that. God, we don't want animals walking around. It's sickening. Believe me, I'm not Haredi. But what can I tell you? I love Torah, and I love Jews who observe Torah. And somehow the Haredim I know are very down to earth, very insightful, very committed, and very devoted, and very lovely. And what a decision, what a decision. And you see the Rebbeim, I read the Haredi press, taking a vacation in Switzerland. And some of them, they've taken a vacation in London. And they don't just fly, private plane at their disposal. And wow, luxury and homes and what it cost and the entourage and the Gabbayim. And you look at the Rebbe. When did he leave? 770. Follow me? When did he leave? We have recorded. And I don't mean, of course, I was once corrected. How can you say? I mean 770, the area. He lived on President Street. But we know he went to the Machanaim, whatever, Bamachaneh, whatever their summer camp is called, the Chabad summer camp. So I think twice or three times he went to visit in the 50s. Maybe early 60s, the final time. So, you know, when did he leave? The dedication, the total Mesirat Nefesh. But it's much more than that. I'm going to make a golden point. I don't know if I'm going to reach it today, but I'll open your eyes, if not today, next time. My dear students, a lot of books, when it comes to the Rav, it's amazing. Only one volume has biographical material on the Rav. One volume. It came out many years ago already. A volume called The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Volume 1. The author, good friend of mine, wrote a biographical sketch of the Rav so she would understand the insights that comprise the rest of the volume in Volume 2. It's amazing. So many years later, no one but no one has written anything about the Rav's life. Everyone is stuck. Against their will, they have to quote that dummy named Rakefet. Believe me. Against their will, they don't have a choice. Why? It's a different question. It's not for now. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, volume after volume, has appeared about the Rebbe and about his life. And you know what's amazing? One volume is better than another, and each one sees the Rebbe from a different vantage point. A volume just came out. I don't know if it's available yet in the stores. It's hand-delivered to Gris for me. The Secret of Chabad, Inside the World's Most Successful Jewish Movement, by David Eliezri, a Rav, Chabad Shaluach, very successful, out on the west coast of the United States. The cover is very dramatic. It shows the Kinas Shluchim in front of 770. It's a very powerful cover. And this just came out, and I wondered, what can he have that no one else has? Tolushkin, Miller, Steinsaltz, Dalfin, so many volumes have come out already in Israel, endless volumes. And I have to say, it's not Miller. Miller is much more inclusive of everything. But this is from the vantage point of a man who has been a shaluach for many decades. It's a very interesting, insightful volume into the Rebbe. Now, beginning on page 58, you see my point that there's a gradual development here. And he tells the following story. If you recall, we ended off last week's class with the sixth Rebbe's death on that Shabbat. And the news spread all over the world. 1950, Chabadnikim were depressed. The Rebbe died. I did not tell you what it means that Rebbe dies. And he describes here that in Tel Aviv, in Nachlat Binyamin Street, that's South Tel Aviv, it's in an area today that needs rejuvenation. In Nachlat Binyamin, there was the big Chabad shul. And everyone was very sad. The entire shul, all the Chabadnikim, ripped Kriya together and sat on the floor together to be Yodsei, the halacha, that when your Rebbe Mufak dies, there has to be an expression of mourning. When the Rav died, you should know, it was Chalamayid. And Rav Aaron Lichtenstein went to ask Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach if he should rip Kriya, Chalamayid, Pesach. And Rav Shlomo Zalman answered, if you're asking the question, you cannot rip. Do you understand the answer? It's a whole machlekes haposkim whether you rip Kriya on Chalamayid. But if you're already asking, it shows you're not overwhelmed by the emotion, so you can't rip. You have to wait till after. I ripped Kriya after Yom Tov. But very interesting what Shlomo Zalman answered him. And here they are sitting around on the floor, and I'm quoting now, the somber mood was shattered by Rav Avraham Pariz. He had traveled to New York before the outbreak of war and was stranded there during the 1940s. He stood up proclaiming, Jews, Mehavana Rebbe, we have a Rebbe, referring to the Ramash, the departed leader's younger son-in-law. No one thought at this moment of mourning about a successor. His audacity shattered the somber feeling in the synagogue. Many of the Hasidim were disturbed about his outburst. Despite the consternation, he continued, quote, I had the honor to get to know him. He tries to hide his greatness. He is fooling us. I worked with him in the same room for 10 years. We have a Rebbe. Now, this Avram Pariz wanted them to send a letter to New York demanding that the younger son-in-law be made Rebbe. No, the Hasidim wouldn't do it. Ma pidom, Rav Shmaya Guraye. But you see, the seeds are being planted. Already during the Shiva in Palestine, which then was a hot, had many Chabadnikim, maybe more than in New York at that time. New York was first getting started. But you see that the name was there. And he goes on, very fascinating. I love this description, how in New York already, people started to approach Reb Menachem Mendel with the awe that you approach a Rebbe. They didn't shake his hand. They referred to him in the third person. There was a feeling of awe, as if he will be the next Rebbe. And he tells the story when a chassid had been long close to the Ramash, refused to shake his hand in a meeting. The Ramash remarked, you too? In other words, what are you, crazy? I'm going to be Rebbe. You too? I'm not shaking my hand. You know, it's like two buddies. You too? But you see, the seeds are being planted. Now, Rav Shmuel Levitan, he is one of the leading Hasidim. In all the pictures of the Rebbe, at from the early 50s into the 60s, you see Rav Shmuel Levitan standing right behind the Rebbe. It's from the famous Levitan family. So, the Rebbe sat in his office, the future Rebbe, I should say, and anyone could knock on the door and go in and speak with him. It's very insightful remark. So Shmuel Levitan said, told a group of his students in Tomchei Tamimim, he said, I want you to notice, people go into the Ramash and they ask him Sheilotin Halacha. And he answers. That doesn't make him a Rebbe. That simply means he's very learned. But do you notice that people go in and ask him for advice on worldly issues, questions of health? And he answers, that is a sign he is willing to accept the position of the Rebbe. Fascinating, gradual, slowly. A year or two later, a whole group of the Elder Hasidim come into the Rebbe with a Ktav Hitkashrut. You know what that means? Rabbinic literature, that when they elected a Rav in a new city, they would give him a Ktav Rabbanut. A Ktav Rabbanut, all the Rabbanim and all the elders of the community signed on. A Ktav Hitkashrut is when Hasidim give a Rebbe a Ktav that they're tying their souls to his soul. They're willing to accept him as Rebbe. Could you imagine they gave the Rebbe, they came in and these were Elder Hasidim who had yet known the fifth Rebbe, Reb Shalom Dovber, not only Reb Yitzchak Yosef, not only the sixth Rebbe. And they give the Rebbe the Ktab Hitkashrut. The Rebbe opens up the envelope, takes out the letter, reading the first line, the Ramash closed the letter and began to cry, sobbing. He asked them to leave, saying, quote, this has no connection to me. And you see, he's fighting an inner struggle. He's fighting an inner battle. Until this point, this is a chassid describing the seventh Rebbe. Until this point, the Ramash was able to dedicate himself to scholarship and personal spiritual development. Now he would have to be totally immersed in the mundane aspects of leading the community. He did not want it. Rav Yoel Kahn, one of the most famous Chabadnikim in the world today, that's the Choseh, you know what I'm talking about? Rav Yoel Kahn, a genius of geniuses. You have no idea what we're talking. This was the man, when the Rebbe spoke on Shabbos, the Fabrengens, Shabbos Mevachim Rosh Chodesh. Later, it was every Shabbos there was something going on. So after Shabbos, Rabbi Yoel Kahn would repeat the Rebbe's talk syllable by syllable by syllable. And they would record it, write it down, and by a few days later, it was published in tens of thousands of copies. Rabbi Yoel Kahn not only could repeat the Rebbe's talk syllable by syllable by syllable, he would grimace when the Rebbe grimaced, he would smile when the Rebbe smiled, and he would cry when the Rebbe cried. It's amazing. By the way, Rabbi Yoel Kahn in the Rakefet book is in the Rakefet Hall of Fame for a different reason as well. He wrote a tremendous response to the Satmarud's Al HaGaula Ba'al HaTmura after the Six-Day War. A tremendous response to the Vayom Moshe. This is Rabbi Yoel Kahn. I have a copy of it in my office. An unbelievable individual. So Rabbi Yoel Kahn, quote, the Rebbe was very reserved, a private person. Public leadership was the opposite of his character. It's unbelievable. This is exactly what the Rebbe said about him. Reb Leibel Groner,
tells the story of the arrival of the Rebbe, the Groner family. These were cousins of the Rebbe, and they were very close to Rabbi Yosef, to Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef, to the sixth Rebbe. And when Rabbi Menachem Mendel arrived, the Rebbe told them, "Go to the port, greet my son-in-law." The entire Groner family came down. All of us, all the students of the yeshiva went to greet him. Down came a youngish man, his beard tied under. I think what it means is beard tied under. Chabadim have a way of tying their beard. It shouldn't look so long. The Rebbe never had that big a beard to begin with. But I believe on the boat, probably coming from Paris, he tied his beard to look only slightly unshaven. And here, he, beard tied under, he came over to every boy. And he projected much warmth. A few days later, the Hasidic community organized a formal welcome. Rabbi Lavel Groner attended with his father, and he observed for 2 hours the Ramash explored the obligation of Hakarat HaTov, that he arrived in America, that people saved him, according to the Talmud. Then another 2 hours, he explored the Hasidic perspective of Hakarat HaTov. And then he connected it all, showing how to apply these ideas to one's personal service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So you can see his reputation preceded him. The monthly Fabrengen, when he spoke, he couldn't hide it. People knew about him. People knew who he was. He dwarfed Rav Shmaya Guraya in learning. Rav Shmaya Guraya was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, a tremendous administrator, totally loyal to the Rebbe, totally loyal to the traditions of Chabad. But he wasn't Reb Menachem Mendel Schneerson. Reb Menachem Mendel Schneerson was Chad B'doro, one in the generation. Now, this pressure was building up and building up and building up, and evidently, at a certain point, the Rebbe never left an autobiography, but at a certain point, the Rebbe gave in and recognized the Hashgacha Pratit had put him in this type of lifestyle, in this place, at this time, for one reason. And then we come back to where we ended off last week's class. I just want to give a drop more detail. That night, beautiful description here. Tremendous tension, tremendous crowd. Yudchet Kislev. Place was mobbed, rumors were spreading all over. Would he or wouldn't he? It's time we have to have a Rebbe. Will he accept? The pressure had built up. Petitions came in from London, from Kfar Chabad in Israel, from all over the United States. And absolute silence filled the room. The crowd held its breath. The hearts of the Hasidim pulsating, waiting to see how the Ramash would respond. It was the middle of winter, and yet they described the room was so suffocating that one of the elder Hasidim fainted from the pressure of the crowd and the heat. The Rebbe walked in about 9:45, and they had prepared 2 seats for the Rebbe. And you read this in all the biographies and all the descriptions now. Everyone is the same. 1 seat was where he usually sat among the Hasidim, up front, but with the crowd. First among equals, but not uniquely first. The other seat was Abinon, up front, where the Rebbe should be seated. Everyone waited to see what seat he would take. When the Rebbe walked in, he walked up front and he took that seat in front. And everyone now was breathless. And then he began to speak. He said, and you can read this in Plushkin, a very wonderful volume, Rebbe by Joseph Plushkin, began to speak. And he said, in America, Allah machina statement. He said the word statement in English. In America, everyone makes a statement. If you're going to hold a press conference, you have to make a statement. So the Rebbe went on, and this is, everyone quotes this. He quoted the Zohar by Yikra. Yisrael v'oraita v'kutshu b'richu chatu. And that in order to be a good Jew, if you just love God, that's not enough. You have to begin by loving your fellow Jew. If someone loves his fellow Jew, then we can teach him to love Torah and to love HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But if someone just says, I believe in God, I love God, but I don't give a hoot about anyone else, he will never be a good Jew. And he says, I'm making the statement that the love that is interconnected between God and Torah and the Jewish people has to begin by love for the Jewish people. Now, in the audience, this is what the memoir literature writes. When the Rebbe said he's making a statement, the Chmacha statement, the American Chmacha statement, so they all thought he was making a statement about that he would accept being the Rebbe. And like everyone was so disappointed, all right, it's a beautiful statement, and you can see the implication of the statement. All right? Yisrael, the Oraita, the Kutcha Berichu. Yisrael comes first. Implications are what Chabad becomes. But people were disappointed. And that's where that 80-year-old plus Chabad rabbi from Manchester, Rabbi Sender Nemtsov, stood up. The Rebbe was a young man compared to him. I mean, this takes guts, but I imagine when you're over 80 and you see the future before your eyes, and he says to the Rebbe in front of everyone, the Divrei Torah is Zeya Shein, the Divrei Torah is very nice, or but the Olam Vil Amaima from the Rebbe. The Olam wants a Maima, and a Maima is something that only a Rebbe says in Chabad. If your Rebbe is willing to say a Maima, that is a sign that the Rebbe, that the Ramash has accepted to become the Admiral of Lubavitch. And the Rebbe began a Maima, which we're going to talk about in detail next week, a very important Maima, Basi Lagani. The Rebbe picked up exactly where the sixth Rebbe left off. Because when the sixth Rebbe died for that Shabbat, he asked Rebbe Menachem Mendel to prepare the manuscript that he was working on, and the manuscript that the sixth Rebbe wanted to publicize was the Pasuk from Shir Hashirim, I've come into my garden, that God wants to visit, God wants to be with the Jewish people, with the Torah people. I've come into my garden, I've come into the Mishkan. God needs us. And that was the last Maima that the sixth Rebbe worked on. And he gave it to Rebbe Menachem Mendel. And that Shabbat he died. And of course the publicity of the Maima became secondary to the news of the Rebbe's death. And that's the Maima that the seventh Rebbe said and began his Rebbeship with, Basi Lagani, and we'll talk about that Maimer in great detail, but that's next time. When the Rebbe finished the Maimer, and again, you'll see the description in Plishkin, I saw with my own eyes, it's very different. It's not the Rav giving his Shia and giving Halacha and Agada and the Olam listening. This is a different experience altogether. The Rebbe is standing, everyone is standing. The Rebbe's eyes are closed. Everything is being done ba'al peh, by heart. The Rebbe is in a different world. He's holding on, I told you, to a handkerchief very tightly. And the reason is that that handkerchief holding on keeps him stationary, that he shouldn't float up to heaven. It's an experience. Do the Hasidim understand the Maima?
I would imagine very few. As the Reb said when they asked him, when he came back from the Fabrenian, so Rebbe said, his different Torah, wonderful, but the Hasidus, I don't understand. It's a different world, but they don't have to understand it. It's like Hakel. The Lamdonim come to learn, the women and children come today, women come to learn too. The children come to observe. It's the feeling, it's the emotion, it's the sight. And the Rebbe gave the Maimer, and when the Rebbe finished, so that chutzpan, Rabbi Nemtsov jumped up again. Despite his age, he jumped on a table and proclaimed, Chassidim, we have a Rebbe, say Shechiyanu. And loudly he made the bracha Shechiyanu b'malcha Shechiyanu b'kimanu, and the entire olam answered amen. Now, I want to come back to the questions I asked. You see, here is the clearest description where the Hasidim decided who the Rebbe should be. Went against the family. That split was never really totally healed. And it affects every Jew in the world today, including some of the very students sitting before me. The Rebbetzin, the widow of the sixth Rebbe, refused, Chamedina, right? Refused to give the Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, you know what she refused to give him? The strangle. Could you imagine? The strangle was part of Chabad. Right or wrong, Hasidus, strangle.
Only the Rebbe.
Part of Chabad. No, there are Hasidim who wear strimals in Israel, and the Rebbe was makpid. If your minute was to wear a strimal, you have to wear a strimal.
Yeah,
you have to continue.
Yeah, but watch.
So the seventh Rebbe did not make an issue out of it, and he waived the strimal. In my opinion, and I may be totally wrong, it's not just the family strife here. I think the Rebbe, we're talking 1950, we want to bring every last Jew alive to Yiddishkeit. The Strimal doesn't really have a place in the modern scene. Rakefet took a line out of his Washington. I know Rakefet well, and he has a very, very good heart. He didn't want to offend anyone. So I had a line in there that I realized my first morning in Moscow that a shrine has nothing to do with Yiddishkeit. We came out of the hotel shaking, shivering, you know, first morning in the Communist Empire after all we had gone through at point of entry. And it was like 9 o'clock in the morning, still quite dark, height of winter. And for a moment I thought I was back in Geula. On Yontif, Shabbos, everyone wore a strimal. Not only men, the women as well. It has to do with the weather in Russia. So I had that line. So the lady who worked on my book, one of the wonderful ladies here, Geffen did a very beautiful job in publishing Washington. I have to compliment them. The index is second to none. The copy editing was fabulous. So this lady, who's a Balat Shuva from a very prominent American family, and her husband must wear a strimal, she gave me sources of the importance of a strimal. So I said to her, I see that sentence offended you. Take it out. My work on Washington will stand or fall without that sentence in it. So I took it out. But I think the Rebbe, I may be wrong, but I believe this, knowing the Rebbe and seeing and my periscope into his mind from the Groner family, he probably felt no need to push a strimal in America. We can be from Jews without a strangle as well. And the Rebbetzin didn't want to give it. Told me, yeah, he could have bought a strangle. What's the big deal? So it would have cost him a few $100. It's the Rebbe. You understand? What's the big deal? I think he made that decision. Don't make an issue out of it. Let her keep the strangle. Finally, I have to say, to the kavod of Reb Shmaya Guraye, and this should never be forgotten. He was a man who was groomed and raised to be the seventh Rebbe. His mother-in-law fought bitterly that he should be the seventh Rebbe. She denied the Shtreimel to his brother-in-law. Reb Shmaya Guraye gradually became a most devoted chassid of Reb Menachem Mendel. And he stood before him b'fneyam v'yeda b'dechilu urechimu. And there are endless pictures that show it, and anyone who was within the Chabad inner circle will tell you about it. And there's even a quote that he said, Rav Shmaya Guraye had a very difficult problem because he ran the Tomchei Tumimim Yeshivat, the Merkaz L'Chinuch. And he had questions and he asked the Rebbe said he would consult the father-in-law when he went to the Yohel. And Rav Shmaya Guraye said he came back with unbelievable answers. He said, that's the difference between us. I could also try to consult my late father-in-law, but I will never understand his answers. The Rebbe understands the answers. That's why I'm his chassid. And this is to his tremendous credit, because family-wise, as we will see, he paid a heavy price for his devotion and dedication to the seventh Rebbe. So to reiterate, we're scratching the surface, but only I have more to say, but we have to leave it. It's an unbelievable individual. I don't believe the decision came lightly. And you see, the Rav, the Hasidim, all describe the same Rebbe in Rabbinic Hebrew, Nechba El Hakelim. Reticent. Who would ever dream that this man would someday be the Lubavitcher Rebbe and affect the entire world? It's not just the Jews, Gentiles as well. To affect every Jew and what's going on. Remember, we're 21 years after his death and it's beyond words what's going on. I heard a guy speak yesterday. He told a story that he got a question in America. And he, you heard what he answered. Don't go to this shul and don't go to that shul. Go to Chabad. And whenever I tell anyone the story that's the advice I gave, everyone, they hug me. They kiss me. They say, wow, you're fabulous. That's great. Maybe Chabad. I hope against hope that they will teach this individual six words. Judaism is perfect. Jews are not. So this was the Rebbe. I showed you how it came about gradually. The story of what his real outlook is vis-a-vis secular knowledge, you can play with it. The Rebbe never answered the question black and white. He wrote hundreds of letters to scientists, to mathematicians. His knowledge was breathtaking. But how come you tell your Hasidim, Beit Yaakov Kadima, no Stern College, no Barnard, no Bar Ilan, Tomchei Tumimim, Kadima, nothing else counts? And yet the Rebbe was Malei B'Gadosh in Chochmat HaOlam, the seven lights of the menorah. It's an interesting question. The side issue is the Rav, which is even a more burning issue. What did he really believe deep down? He was not a Hirschian. What's the ultimate vision? B'chol banayach limudei Hashem. Do we need a Bar Ilan? Do we need a YU? Do we need a Machon de Technologia? Machon Lev? Interesting question. We can debate it, but the question is better than any answer we'll come up with, because the Rav is not here, and you know the question is if we had this ability, this choice, to live without university. How the Rebbe becomes Rebbe, I think my approach is correct. I don't know. It's what all the memoir literature seems to say. And being my age and having so much life experience, I think my description is accurate. But here we are. We have a Rebbe. He has accepted. The Shechiyanu has been uttered. The Hasidim have triumphed. It leaves the family divided, which has grave implications for the 1980s, as we will see. But this is the reality of life. We don't write the script. We have to live with the punches. Now, I want to wish everyone a Gemar Tov, an easy fast. According to the radio, they're scaring us with the weather, but we can talk about the weather. We can't do much about it. But my own advice is, if it's going to be as hot as they say, just be stationary. The less you walk, daven, kavana, and zhalavid de koiches. How do you say that in English? I don't know. Zhalavid de koiches. Morty, give me a translation. Zhalavid de koiches.
Conserve your energy.
Use your energy constructively. And it should be a great fast, and we should only have besorah tova. It's innate sara liyakov, as we generally have, but somehow this is so depressing with all the rocks and the firebombs. And yesterday, if you look at the papers today, that girl's life was saved miraculously. The rock landed a half inch away from her in the car. And we should only have a government that can do, and the prime minister going to Russia, this is not a simple matter, taking the chief of staff with him and the head of intelligence in the army. If you know a little bit about the Israeli army, it's not a simple matter what's happening in Syria with all the weapons that are now coming in. So the Eibishter should watch over us and give us strength, and it should be the Machatima Tov Aleinu V'al Kol Yisrael, and a wonderful Chag HaSukkot, and the Torah we spoke about yesterday in Chag HaSukkot should be Mitgashemet Leineinu Bevlo Muvan Hamila. If anyone wants a free gift, this is Rav Arush. What a brilliant, brilliant speaker. Breslov? A brilliant speaker. Do I agree with everything on it? No, I mean, it's a little bit of a world that's alien to me, but the heart of it is fabulous. This is very interesting where we're at. Jewish Week, an article in the Reconstructionist movement, they're now debating whether they can ordain intermarried rabbis. Ordaining intermarried rabbis could push the Reconstruction movement to the fringes or forge a model for the future. And they're debating what Mordechai Kaplan would have to say. And just think with the Chovevei Torah innovations, what ultimately it leads to. This is a very interesting article of a little city where a famous Hebrew writer, Devorah Baron, and where Moreno Rabbeinu Rav Moshe Feinstein grew up. And they go back to visit the city. Also, it has some nice pictures of Rav Moshe and of Chara Menuchat, as you will see. This is Sid Lyman and my Talmud, Mark Shapiro. It's about Vilna, and once again, they want to build in Schnippeschnuck, which is a suburb. I mean, I saw this with my own eyes, on top of the Jewish cemetery that existed for hundreds and hundreds of years, the communists built a sport culture center. Now the democracy that's taken over wants to destroy the whole cemetery and build totally over it. And they've paid off a Jewish woman and she's in favor. It's very, very sad. The Rabbanim are opposing. Then you have Mark Shapiro with his usual catching art scroll in a compromising position. I'll leave it to Mark. Anyone interested? This was being given out in my shul. Slichat Limud al Savlanut v'Havat Yisrael. And this is really beautifully done. Chabad would agree with this 1,000%, my Mari Chazal, and how it applies in modern times. So Tzom Kal, Gemar Tov, Chag Sameach, we pick up again the week after Sukkot. Be'ezrat ha'natein le'av koach, until we meet again in health and happiness, Das V'danya. Which, by the way, was the Rebbe's second native language, outside of Yiddish, Russian. He goes by Rabbi. He's Rabbi. He's a medical doctor. Forget about the rabbi. He has to concentrate on being the greatest doctor in the world. Got it? He's a specialist within a specialty. Are you aware of that? He's a dermatologist with a specialty in the problems caused by the sun. He's really skilled. He's very bright. He is very, very bright. And you know how he was raised? You know the tragedy? You know they had to overcome? No? Do you remember in Kew Gardens Hills, a dryer exploded, killing a woman who was pregnant and a little girl that was his mother and sister. And he was a little boy at the time, he and his brother. That's a dryer, a gas clothes dryer. And that's, you know, the family. And his grandmother, she stepped in and took over Isha Gadola, Norma Holzer. And these two kids turned out, and then she arranged the shidduch. Jay remarried a balat tshuva who worked in the OU. Jay's father also was there. And they have a son, Nisan, the salt of the earth. And Nebuch, Cheryl, I go to visit her grave whenever I'm in Beit Shemesh. Cheryl was the daughter buried right under. I taught Cheryl's brother and I taught Cheryl's sister. That was his mother. Did you follow? That we go through in life. So he's and Rachel is very, very special. Have you met her yet?
I met her, yeah.
She is very special.
The last year that you gave, I came home, Laura wasn't here, but I came home, and so we came home, she was at our door, and we were talking.
Wow, that's
they live in our block. Well, they moved into our block.
I am so happy. 058-627-2411. Okay, I am so glad. My wife will call. So when do you go back?
30th. Not in time to prepare next class.
No. And, all right. Anything happen with...
I invited him. Yeah.
Yeah, you told him?
He said he wants to call you, so
I'll just say them.
Thank you so much.
Sarat Tovat.
Amen.
All right, I got to write down where I'm up to, because by the time we meet again, a lot of new water will go under the dam. Have I described the Rebbe honestly? What do you say? For a Litvak? You don't realize who this man was. It's overwhelming. But I have to explain. I have a golden point to make. And this Eliezeri, very insightful. I understand he's a very successful shaluch. He's built an empire.
Where is he?
Someplace near, beyond San Francisco, near Palo Alto. Hmm. Further up. It's an empire. And I can't get over another volume.
Great picture.
Yeah, it's a great cover.
Yeah.
And this is Telushkin's cover.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also interesting, you know, they stand there. Okay, start after May Weber. Start Chiddush of Chadhu.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're going to have have them. I have a very busy sukkah, so I didn't have Parsha Bereishit to come to lunch. And if the Rebbe wants, you're welcome to join us if you want to come to Shabbos. Stay. I don't know if it fits into your schedule.
Parsha Bereishit. One second, let's talk with Monica.
I'm serious. That's it. Can I give you my phone?
One second. You have room for us?
Yes.
You have room. Okay, so one second. What's your phone number?
050.
Yes.
7775.
Okay, so if it works for you. 050-7775. I have a wedding coming up for grandson. That's why I said Schlissel. He was running after the girl for a while. That's the marriage is like going to be 2 months after the engagement, if that long.
What's the connection to the famous Schlissel?
I got to check. I said that. Did I say that today or yesterday?
Yesterday.
I got to check. I have to check because they could be related. It's shy because these are two families that are mushrashim. They're here generations. Adler and Schlissel, those are our two parents. I taught the girl's aunt in Mechaya. Eshti Adler was an ishiyot. Go and dream, you know, what happens later in life, that her niece. But this grandson is very interesting. It's my youngest daughter. This youngest daughter has 6 children. She's married to a Yekka who was at least a Yekka when I met him the first time, a dentist, Fairleigh Dickinson, last graduate, but always wanted to settle here. An uncle, Rav Avner, well-known Yekka, very big Yekka family.
Is this Jerry Samuel's son?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very thin.
Yeah.
So I can't call him a Yekka today because he's a Makubal, you know, he's got a beard down to here.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He works enough to make a little living. He's a very good dentist. And at my age, that's an achievement. But he learns that. Now, the kids, each kid was raised like the kid could choose. Every kid is different. This Shoham, I spoke at the engagement party. I tied it in with everybody. The gist of it was, my kids are looking for education, you know, from no, a lot like I spoke about, no outside influence. He went to Haredi education, Chardali, Shas education, Chardal high school. He wound up in Siach Yitzchak, you follow? And then he did army, you know, in Hezder, and he's now finished 3 years of Betzalel. He's in art design, he's a genius in what he's in, and so he's such a fascinating young man. And he met this girl. He's very tall. I don't know how he got that tall. He's 6'6". He's the tallest of all my grandchildren. And his father's shorter than I am. My other sons-in-law tower over me. And I don't know where he got that way. He couldn't get into a tank. He almost couldn't go into the tank car because he's so tall. Thank God they let him in. So he chased this girl, and she's a sweetheart. Her mother was just written up in Makor Rishon. She's big in Chinuch. She's in charge of Tanakh. She's fighting with Rabbanim. Rabbanim are fighting with her. Agreed. You know, Begovai Naim, the whole debate, how you teach Tanakh here. So she has one problem. She's the youngest of 4, twins and 2 above. No one else is married. So she said she can't say yes. She can't say yes. She can't offend her older sister. And then the miracle happened, she caved in. And as her grandfather said at the engagement party, wow, it was a long courtship, but a very short engagement. So I got to see, I got to be sure that there's no offer of that job. Anyway, I got to talk it over with Malcolm. Okay, if we should have the energy, absolutely. Okay, absolutely. That would be something. That would be something.
You did the send off apparently in Queens, right? So you
can
do the
we can do the welcome. We can do the welcome. The can I know?
Hit both sides of it.
We can do the welcome here. Okay. Do the welcome here. I got to work on names, but we'll leave that for.
How are you?
How are you?
Regards to the upper generation. The side generation and beyond.
Yes, you know,
enjoy your trip.
Thank you.
Very funny. He said, but we have a dentist. We got him. He's my son's neighbor in the Bay Daniel. He's a dentist. And I also find out he's a mole, a sofer, and he stitches up kids in the Bay Daniel when they fall and everything. So I figured, you know, like, that makes an extra. Turns out, I found out from your present, he won't take a penny for anything. He says, I have a job. He says, I thank you for letting me be the mole and have the mitzvah. He will not take, you know, you go to these mole, even they say, no, whatever you want. And then they say, as long as it's a...
Right.
He says...
What's his name? Ari Greenspan?
So he won't take a penny, anything, for anything he does. Daniel Kasowitz.
Wow. And where is he from?
I guess from New York or something.
Wow. I just have to. Here I got a whole thing. You know, I asked why they don't accept the prenup. So here's a whole. One of the Chabadnikim, a big lamdan, wrote a whole thing against it, was the diasmachta problem. I'm aware of it, but at least it's something.
But all of a sudden, for a number of years, they went.
Yeah, many rabbanim accept it. So we're dealing with a bidyavid situation.
Hold on, my brother won't marry anybody.
No.
Better than Ezekiel yet.
Tell me, what type of guy was Marvin? Was he part of the Kehila in Rehovot? Entelman.
Yeah, he was much more active in Burma than the American show. Choice words about him. I mean, I used to talk to him because he was a Weitzman. He was originally a physicist, so I'm a physicist. So we would talk, you know, friendly, like not physics, but different.
No,
but we talked friendly and stuff.
But he always was idiocentric in the yeshiva too. He gets smicha from Rav Chutna. He went from yeshiva college to Chaim Berlin. I don't know of anyone else who did that. And he was a sweet guy.
He was very friendly and everything.
Sweet guy. And he meant L'shem Shemayim. So do you have that book that I showed
you?
You know, it's a rare book today. It's very valuable.
Yeah, I looked up on here. It's not on Hebrew books.
Not on Hebrew. They don't want to put it on. I guess someone senses what they put on there. Come, but I just got to go down to Sherry and away we go. I can't. I can't do it now. I have so much to do, and I'm getting hit with shiva calls. God, like on Chodesh Elul and Tishrei, he calls in too many people. He's making a cash.
What's the big minion?